Good night, everybody. It is good to see each of you here tonight. Midweek service. Got a few prayer requests I'd like to bring up again also for you. We're going to be at 1 Corinthians chapter 10, so if you want to turn your Bible there again, you sure can. Well, tonight, we're going to be looking at 1 Corinthians 10 once again, and I'd like for you to read me for right now. Let's just go on down to verse 11 from 1 Corinthians 10, 1 to 11. Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers were under the cloud. All passed through the sea. All were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. All ate the same spiritual food and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they drank of that spiritual rock that followed them, and that rock was Christ. But with most of them God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. Now these things became our examples, to the intent that we should not lust after evil things as they also lusted. And do not become idolaters, as were some of them, as it is written, the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. Neither let us commit sexual immorality, as some of them did, and in one day 23,000 fell. Nor let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted, and were destroyed by the serpents. Nor complain, as some of them also complained, and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the ages have come. And I want to back off here just a minute. The word that's used for examples here is the word tupos. Tupos. And we get our word type from that. T-Y-P-E. The word is, if you transliterate it, T-U-P-O-S. And the U in the Greek language becomes a Y in our language. So it's type. So we talk about types. And the word tupos means pattern. It means model. It means a mold. It means example. It's used of a fingerprint. It's used of copy. It's used as type. Like you have as a typewriter. Well, a typewriter just has all the special little characters and set in a mold there, set in a pattern there, and when you strike a key, that goes up and strikes a ribbon that puts that pattern onto the paper that you're typing on. So it's that kind of a type. So it's a pattern, and we can call it kind. It means a kind of thing. And we see it used twice in 1 Corinthians 10, verses 6 and verse 11. But what Paul is going to do is makes an example of the whole episode of the Exodus. So looking back at verse 1 again, notice what he says. Moreover, brethren, I do not want you to be unaware that all our fathers. Now get the picture here. This is not all Jewish people. He's not writing to an all Jewish audience. Matter of fact, many of them are not Jewish. They are Gentile. Yet he's having them identify with all the fathers of the Jewish people, because he's not talking about Gentiles here. He's now talking about the fathers who were under the cloud. And I want you to notice what he says. He directs us to understand the completeness of the exit from Egypt. It was all of them. Now that was we'll get to that in just a minute. All of them were under the cloud. All of them passed through the sea. Now what cloud is he referring to? What cloud is he referring to? They're all under the cloud. Yes, that would be the Shekinah glory, which was a cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night. It was the presence of God, the Shekinah glory, and they were all in that. Nobody missing. Everybody was in that. They all passed through the sea. There he's referring to the Red Sea, where Moses, they all went through on dry land. And then it says they were all baptized into Moses. That is, they were all in. It was a baptism as a word for total immersion. They were totally immersed in Moses. Didn't have any other leaders. Didn't have anybody else. They weren't divided what they were doing. They were all baptized into Moses as they crossed the sea and as they crossed, as they were under the cloud. They all ate the same spiritual food. Everybody got to eat manna. Everybody did. There wasn't an exclusion of anybody. and they all drank the same spiritual drink. So when they got a drink of water, they're all drinking from the same water. Nobody had their own separate water over here. Nobody had the... Now, let me share with you why that's important. This book is about a church that's a divided church. This church had a group of people that said, well, we're more spiritual than you are because Peter was our teacher. And others would say, no, no, we're more spiritual than you are because Paul was our teacher. Others said, we had the eloquent speaker, Apollos, as our teacher, so we all follow Apollos. And some were being so arrogant to say, not us, we follow Jesus, just Jesus. Okay. So there was this schism that was going on with them already. Some of them were having communion together, but they weren't inviting everybody to share at their table. So they had some problems in 1 Corinthians 11 with people not getting to eat at the communion table with everybody else. Matter of fact, what they were doing, they would get together with two or three other families and say, why don't you bring a roast beef this weekend, and we'll bring the corn and potatoes, and you bring the bread and so forth, and you bring the wine. And they said that to this small group of people here. But the poor people who didn't have any more than just bread or any more than just grape juice, they couldn't even afford the good wine, they were not invited to that table. So they had to sit over there and hope they could share bread and wine together because that's really all they had. So the church was a very divided church. They were divided over spiritual gifts. Who had the best spiritual gifts? And some of them were saying, we have better gifts than you. I don't even know if you're included in this or not, but we all speak in tongues. You don't. So those of you who don't, you're not really spiritual people. Well, Paul's wanting to know this. All of you got saved by the same Jesus, all right? None of you got saved any other way. None of you were good enough to be saved. All of you were saved by the same Jesus, just like all of our fathers were delivered by Moses. Okay, so he's getting to that point. Well, I don't want to get ahead of myself here. Let's go ahead and look at number two. As with the children of Israel, when God brought all of them out of bondage equally, including some Gentiles who wanted to go with them. By the way, if you haven't looked back at that again, when they left Egypt in the Exodus, there were Gentiles who attached themselves to that group, and they went with them, non-Jewish people who went with them. And so too had the Corinthians been brought out of the bondage of sin equally. They had all been equally redeemed by faith in the Lord Jesus Christ with no exceptions. Even though Moses was leading the people, he was no more spiritual than any of the rest of them who were coming out. He may have been the leader, but he was not better than them. They were just simply following him. Okay. So he's wanting to see the inclusiveness that's in the salvation we have. It's a completeness. Everybody was saved. Okay. Then number three, simply because they had been delivered out of the bondage of sin was no guarantee they would make it to the victorious Christian life. Now, let's go back just for a minute, because I think when I get to speak on these, I'm going to take us back through the Exodus itself and show how that's a type of the Christian life. That's an example of the Christian life. You'll see some of it right here, but I want to go a little more in depth with you. What was the purpose of them leaving Egypt? What's their destination? Ultimately, it's the promised land, isn't it? So that's where they're headed. It wasn't just to get out of Egypt. Everybody with me on that? It wasn't just to get out of Egypt. Now, when they got to the promised land, were they going to get there alive or dead? Supposed to get there alive or dead? Alive. The goal was to get there alive. There you go. They have to go and be alive, right? Now, reason I'm saying it, because you'll have a book right in here, a song right in here that say, on Jordan's stormy banks I stand and cast a wishful eye to Canaan's fair and promised land where my possessions lie. I'm bound for the promised land, and that song is about going to heaven. Follow that? And then one day I'll cross that river and face life's trials no more, wrote the Gaithers to us. Because the crossing of the Jordan was seen as going into heaven. Folks, promised land isn't about going to heaven. Okay? It's not about going to heaven. It's about finally living a victorious Christian life. But may I say, you do have to go through trials to get there. And they did. One of the main trials they went through, once again, was not getting out of Egypt. It was getting the Egypt out of them. They had to be weaned from their old ways of doing things. And that took them 40 years. And even then, many of them didn't get to go to the promised land. Many of them, in their stubbornness, died. You follow where I'm at? They didn't ever make it. Now, don't you get the picture? This is about living the victorious Christian life. If the promised land's a picture of heaven, that's not very much fun to me. What did they have to do when they got to the promised land? It was work. What they got to do? Yeah, it's going to be obedience. What do they have to do to get that land? It's a fight. Think of all the enemies you had to fight. And may I say to you, they didn't get rid of all the enemies. It's another 400 years. You're up with Saul and David and Solomon still having to fight all those people who they didn't get rid of. That's a long time, kids. Everybody see where I'm at? So if that's supposed to be a picture of heaven, I'm not looking too forward to heaven. How about you? If I know that the heaven I'm going to is going to be fighting and trouble and more work and more diligence of that kind right there, I don't know. If I'm going to have to worry about enemies attacking my flocks all the time or enemies attacking my crops all the time, I don't know if that's really such a neat heaven. It's because it's not. Oh, they sure did. And we're going to take a closer look at that. But what I want you to see is it's about living a victorious Christian life. As long, when they got to that promised land, as long they trusted the Lord, what happened to their enemies? They defeated them. Big ones. Some of those guys were 10 feet tall and taller. That's some pretty big enemies. You remember they said, we look like grasshoppers in their eyes. Well, that's some pretty big enemies, and they overcame them when they trusted the Lord. What happens to your enemies when you trust the Lord? Same thing. You follow me? Because this picture of going into the promised land is a picture of the victorious Christian life, not of heaven. Fair enough? Okay. Hi, Larry. You need something? Good to see you, buddy. Oh, I am. Thank you. These, so far, they have not risen up against me once. Amen. All right. Then let's get this picture. Simply because they had been delivered out of the bondage of sin was no guarantee they'd make it to the victorious Christian life. So just because they all got away from the Egypt, and I want to just clarify this right now. Just because Jesus Christ delivered you out of sin is not a guarantee that you're going to live a victorious Christian life. Everybody seen that? It's not a guarantee. There are struggles that we're going to go through, and if I can say it this way, many of us are never going to make it to living a victorious Christian life because we just can't get out of the wilderness. We just can't leave Egypt behind. It's got such a taste for us. Now, notice this. You're not dying as a slave. You're dying as a delivered person. But you never got to make it to the victorious Christian life, that place where you could be genuinely fruitful, because that's not done the way we normally do things. Everybody with me on this? Comments, questions, thoughts? All right. Let's go to letter B then. He brings them to see that not all of them made it to the promised land, the victorious, spirit-led, fruitful Christian living. Look, if you would, at verse 5. But with most of them, God was not well pleased, for their bodies were scattered in the wilderness. God says he was not pleased with most of them and scattered their bodies in the wilderness. So in other words, they never got to make it to that promised land. They got to see it. The 12 spies told them about it. They got right up to the crossing point and almost did it, but wouldn't commit. They wouldn't make that final commitment that took them into that victorious spot. They stopped and said, no, we won't go. Lack of faith. And I want to share that with you tonight. That's really going to be our big point for tonight. These are the practices Paul tells us are examples for us. As a matter of fact, let's go to Colossians 1. Colossians 1, 21 to 23. Now, some are going to say, wait a minute, Pastor, are you teaching us that we're not eternally saved? I didn't say any such thing. I'm teaching you this, that you can be eternally saved and never get to victorious Christian living. Never get to that Spirit-filled life that is a life of fruitfulness. Listen to what he says here in Colossians 1 and 21. And you who once were alienated and enemies in your mind by wicked works, yet now he has reconciled. So is that us? Yeah, we once were enemies. Our minds were set against him, and because of that, wicked works came from that. He reconciled us in the body of his flesh through death to present you holy and blameless and above reproach in his sight. Now watch what verse 23 says. If indeed you continue in the faith, grounded and steadfast, and are not moved away from the hope of the gospel which you heard. Now, I know there's a comment, it goes on talking about which is preached to every creature under heaven. My point was looking at this. If indeed you continue in the faith, grounded and steadfast, and not moved away from the hope of the gospel which you heard. What I want to show you tonight is the reason they didn't go in is because that's what happened to them. They quit believing. They quit heading in the direction of who Christ is. They got caught up with philosophy. They caught up with vain deceit. They got caught up with the world. They got caught up with asceticism. They got caught up with a whole lot of things, and that drove them away from it. That's at least that's what it was in Colossians. So any comments or questions about that so far? Yeah, it's time not to stand. It's time to kneel down. Yeah. All right. Well, let's go back to our outline. Number two, these are the practices Paul tells us are examples for us. There are five things he did that Paul warns us not to do because they are displeasing to God. So I want you to take a look at these five things with me. Verse 6. Now, these things were examples to the intent that we should not what? Do not lust after evil things. Okay, so that's the first one. They lust, and it's teaching us not to lust after evil things. Now, once you get the picture here, they did these things, and God was not pleased with them and scattered their bodies in the desert. In other words, he left them alone. They died. They didn't get to go any further. That promised land that was out there, the land flowing with milk and honey, the land that was going to be fruitful for them, the land was going to be thriving for them, they're never going to make it there. Because they just couldn't get past desiring evil things. Now let's talk about this. This shows an intentional lack of trust in God. It insults God's power to provide all that is needed by expressing dissatisfaction with what he has given. Look, they had this dissatisfaction. They didn't like what was going on, so they kept lusting for something else. Yes, I know that we have this bread. But, oh, the leeks and the onions, if we just had some seasonings, ew, it would be so much better. Well, finally they said, meat. We just need meat. We've been eating this bread for so long. We just need meat. And they brought meat to them, quails. Now, men are knocking these quails down and, honestly, pulling the feathers off and eating their flesh raw. I want you to think with me for just a moment what that means. That means the life of the flesh was still in there, because that's the life of the flesh is in the blood. So they weren't even giving these things time to be drained. They're just knocking them down, pulling off the feathers, and eating them. Weren't even cooking them. No, because they had lusted after that God had not provided for them. That's what made it evil. Don't walk out of here tonight, Pastor said, quails are evil. No, that's not what I mean. The way they were doing it was evil. There was no gratitude in their hearts. There was no cooking in the food. There was no draining the blood out of it. They were just eating. See, that's not the Mosaic law that said that. That was the Noahic law that said that. The Noah's law said, do not eat the flesh, or the flesh with the blood still in it. The life of the flesh is in the blood. Don't eat that. Yes, they were after evil things. They were after doing things that God had not provided for them. And then when he did, they didn't do it with gratitude. They didn't do it with even the proper thought for what you're supposed to do with this meat. So it became an evil thing. But that wasn't the only evil thing they lusted after. They would lust after water. They would lust after leeks and onions. They lust after going back to being a slave again because it was an easier way of life. It was a standard way of life, I guess is a better way to say it. They knew what was going to happen. You get up each day and you know you're going to work. You go to bed that night because you had a meal that you... So you had everything you wanted. Going back from where God had delivered you is an evil lust. You know, I played music for a good number of years. I think I was in 13 different bands over my time. The last band was doing very, very well. I was making a living at doing it. That's not what I was doing for a living, but I could make a living pretty good. By that time, I was a union musician, and $50 an hour was what I was getting about that time. So, and that's in 1970. So wasn't bad. But it was a hard life. It's late nights. It's out on the road. It's coming back. You're driving back in the morning, 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning, and it was just a hard life. Then I came to the church. Wow. Even though I had pretty long hair at the time, there was no more bars, no more drinking, no more foolishness, no more madness. And I thought, boy, this is a pretty good thing. There's nobody. Yet, the more I was in the church, well, here, even one guy, I kept cutting my hair a little bit shorter all the time. And one man came up and said, "Hey, we'd like to invite you over to our house for dinner and singing with us." "Oh, okay. I was going to do it a long time ago." I said, "Oh, yeah, but that old hippie hair, I'm not going to let you in my house with that." And I thought, really? And this is the believers in Christ. This is what they're about, huh? And then I got to finding the little infighting that went on, the little hypocrisies that went on. And at one point I told Char, "You know, I'm done with this stuff. I'm going back to the band. At least we got along. At least we knew what the limits were, and we knew what we could do and what we couldn't do, and you could shoot your mouth off if you needed to and know that somebody's going to be right back in your face and it's going to be over in a few minutes anyway. But with this Christian stuff, it's hypocritical, it's quiet, it's hidden. You never know what agendas you are. You never know what landmines you're going to step on. You just don't know who you're going to offend next. I'm going back to the band." And she said, "Please don't. Please don't do that. That's such a hard life for all of us. Just don't do that, please." It took me a long time to figure out how in the world do you get along with this Christian bunch. You know what I'm saying? Can you get the picture then, if you understand what I mean by that, as you're out there in this tent life, camping for the 26th year, eating donuts and drinking water? You think you'd ever get tired of that? You think you'd ever say somewhere along the way, "Duh, just to go back for some liver and onions. I tell you, I would never complain about liver and onions again if we could go back there and just have some liver and onions. What do you say? Let's just mount up and go back home. We got work there. We got things we can do there. And you never have to beg for water. That Nile's right there. You got to drink anytime you want. Out here, what we got? Weren't enough graves in Egypt? Now we just die out here." You know what I'm saying? After a while, you start lusting after things that God has not provided. And you start thinking, God just isn't providing enough. This just isn't a good life. And that's what was going on with them. They're lusting after evil things. Well, we'll go on to the next thing, because I want you to look what it says in verse 7. "And do not become idolaters as some of them were." As were some of them. Well, let me get my page turned here. There we go. I should go on further and say, distrusting people always want what they are not told they cannot have. That's one of the ways when you tell your children you can't have that, they're bound and determined they want whatever that is. They don't even know what it is, but they'll want it. Why not? And there's this desire, this lust to do things. Well, do not become idolaters, verse 7. This demonstrates lack of confidence in God as the supreme God. By declaring faith and allegiance to the image of a lesser God to receive their worship and to receive it from this phony, their daily desires, they had insulted the integrity of God. Now get this. They had been living in Egypt steeped in idolatry. The Egyptians were idolatrous people. Many have said that the 10 plagues were the battle against 10 of their gods. Okay. So they had these gods that they'd been used to there. They were used to idolatry. They at least could see what god they were worshiping. You know, if it's a golden calf, they could see it's a golden calf. If it's a eagle-headed man, they know it was an eagle-headed man. That's what they saw, and that's what they've been used to. But when Moses led them out, all they could see was this cloud. There's no image in that cloud. You don't know what that is. You could see this pillar of fire. There's no image in that. You don't know what that is. It's just a weird cyclone. That's all. It's this cloud and fire that just keeps on going. We're just following. I don't know what we're following. I don't even know what any of this is. They were accustomed to idolatry. So when they didn't know what God was doing anymore, when God seemed quiet, when God seemed like he didn't say much, let me just say this. Abraham didn't get to hear from God real often. David didn't get to hear from God real often. Matter of fact, go back and look at all those heroes of the faith. There were many mundane days they went through in which the voice of God didn't speak at all. Everybody see where I'm at? Well, they went through 40 days where God didn't speak at all, and they said, well, Moses is gone. God's not talking anymore. Let's just do what we know what to do. The gods are upset with us. That's what we're out here by ourselves. The gods are upset with us. Let's build ourselves an idol. So they did. Do you realize that that is such a dissatisfaction with God? It's looking at something that's phony and counting on it to take care of us. Now, we probably will not ourselves go out and build any golden calves or any wooden statues or anything like that. We probably won't do that. But when it comes to God not meeting our needs, where will we go? You know, I think our current American affairs, having given us Facebook, internet, news, all of that stuff that's just a constant flood of stuff all the time, has caused us to spend so much time thinking about the government. The government. The government. Our provider. Our father. The one who takes care of us. The one who's going to... It's craziness. We spend our time wanting profit. Wanting some way, we can't even think about doing things without there being some money involved with it somewhere along the way. And let me see if I can show what I mean. I grew up during the Cold War era. That's post-World War II. With the Koreans, the Soviets, the Chinese, every day a threat that a nuclear blast was going to take us all away. Every day the concern that the communists were going to be taking us. Communists in America, communists all over the place, communists everywhere. And we were listening to Stalin's murderous stuff that he was doing all the time. Stalin sometimes is making Hitler look like a kid. But Stalin would get a bye on what he did because he was an ally with us against the Nazis. But he was killing just as many people. Khrushchev did as many killings. And then when you had the guys in Cambodia, the guys in China, Mao Zedong, killing off lots and lots of people. I grew up understanding communism was a continuous threat to us. Everybody see where I'm at? It was always going to take our lives. This was a serious thing. And we knew of the atrocities they were doing to people everywhere. So today I see an article that was emailed to me, and in this article it was sent from Acton University. It was talking about this in Estonia, a monument that had been placed up, much like our Vietnam War Memorial. And on it they had placed the names of 22,000 people who had been murdered or taken away to Siberia, all by the communists. And the people never got to say goodbye to them. Matter of fact, they never really even knew what happened to them, especially all those that were shipped to Siberia. Far as they know, they died in Siberia. They never got to say goodbye to them, never got to do anything like that. So Estonia decided they were going to put up, Estonia, how big is Estonia? 22,000 of their people just murdered, just gone. They could be with you at work one day and not show up at work the next day. They might be on their way home and someone took them there and you never saw them at home again. Last time you saw them when they left for work that day, and you're never going to see them again. Well, they put up this memorial, 22,000 names on this huge wall. And of all things, at the same time, Walmart, through a third-party seller, but nonetheless, it's on the Walmart webpage. It's the Walmart, you order it through Walmart, has a T-shirt, no, several T-shirts and hoodies, that are the hammer and sickle. Now, I don't know if that means anything to you, but the hammer and sickle to me is communist Russia. That's the sign of murder. That's the sign of people who went into Cuba and murdered people, people who went into all the Eastern European countries and murdered people. That's what we saw. And now they're selling that T-shirt so you can buy a hammer and sickle T-shirt? That's an insult. You understand? Why would anybody honor that state system? That's idolatry. You understand where I'm coming from? No, you're not bowing down to a shrine. Here's this representation, this hammer and sickle that the whole leftist university folk always said, no, the communists will work. This system will really work. This will really work. And it was a murderous system. It never worked. And here, Walmart is selling the T-shirt for it? Now look, you can't sell things there's not a market for. That means somebody is buying that stuff. That's idolatry. Everybody see where I'm at on this? The whole thing of making a profit for everything ultimately winds up being idolatry. And that may offend somebody. I'm not trying to offend you. I'm just trying to simply say, when you have that mindset, okay, so he said, don't be idolaters. Letter C in our outline, verse 8, that's what it says, nor let us commit sexual immorality, as some of them did. So this demonstrates a lack of confidence in God's created order by perverting it to meet their own desires. They had shown more faith in their body's sexual gratification than in the God who had demonstrated his might and power coming out of Egypt. They cared more about what their bodies could do for that momentary time of sexual gratification than they cared about their God. That was insulting to him. Everybody see where we're at on that? Numbers, letter D, do not tempt Christ, verse 9. Nor let us tempt Christ, as some of them also tempted and were destroyed by serpents. In this one, testing God's ability and capability by always doubting it or requesting further proof is a great insult to the character of God and what you've already seen him do. When they would complain about, well, yeah, this is food, but what is it? This is like a bun. It's kind of a sweet bun-like thing. Yeah, we get energy from it, but inside my mouth, I could want something else. What it was? You don't know us enough to know what we want to eat? Testing Christ. Where's water? We don't have water. Testing Christ. You understand where it comes from? Now look, what it's telling us is they did this testing thing. Don't us do the testing thing. What wound up with them? They died in the wilderness and never got to the victorious Christian life. Don't commit adultery or idolatry. Don't commit sexual immorality. Don't lust after evil things. And now don't be don't tempt Christ. And the letter E, found in verse 10. It says here, nor complain, as some of them also complained, and were destroyed by the destroyer. Now, verse 10, complaining about God through doubt, dissatisfaction, and continuous murmuring about everything, expressing dissatisfaction by either refusing what is given or begrudgingly receiving it. This is insulting to those who hear it, and even more insulting to God, who has already given us abundant grace, love, goodness, and mercy. You know, I don't think there's anything more discouraging at times than to be at work with everybody who's complaining about being at work. Or even in your own family. I can only imagine what it is to fix a dinner to have the family say, oh, I hate that. That's no good. I don't like that. That again? This is leftovers. I don't like leftovers. I didn't limit it to children. I just said simply to be in a family and hear that going on. You understand what I'm saying? Imagine if you are God and you've been providing for people for all those years and that's what you're getting to hear. This again? We're tired of manna. We're tired of just water. We want some good old wine again. How about some good old Mountain Dew would be great if we could just have a little bit of coffee, you know? And hearing that, so complaining. And any complaint is a complaint against God and his lack of provision. So he gave us those five things that we should be very, very cautious about. He said that's what caused they were unable to please God. So he left them in there. Letter F. It is just as well for them to die in the wilderness. I mean, we can sometimes say, what kind of God is this that just gets so upset with people, he just kills them because they don't treat him right? He should be bigger than that. You understand what I'm saying? You'll hear people say that about parents. They're just kids. Why are you disciplining them? They're just kids. And you can say, here's God that's disciplining his own family. He is letting some of them die in the wilderness. They're not going to make it to the promised land. And it's just as well they did. Because if he allowed them to go into the promised land with that kind of attitude, what's it going to do to everybody else? Soon as they cross that Jordan River, they're going to say, can you believe that? I just washed this robe and we just got it wet again. I'm tired of this. What does it matter? Can't he find a good way for us to get there? What? We got to go against that walled city? Oh, no. What's he thinking? What? You mean we're going to walk around and just every now and then blow a horn? What kind of stupid idea is that? You understand what I'm saying? What's going to happen? You're going to discourage the people. So you're better off to have those die out in the wilderness than you are have them cross over that land and discourage everybody. Everybody see what I'm coming from on this? All right. Well, die in the wilderness. They would have died in the promised land, and they would have discouraged others while they were doing. Now, number three. Now, look at this. Let's go back to number five again. But with most of them, God was not well pleased. See that well pleased there? I want you to think with me. Paul would write in another place that this is people who live according to the flesh and cannot please God. Look at Romans 8:8 just for a moment. Romans 8:8. Romans 8:8 says, so then those who are in the flesh cannot please God. In other words, they are not able to please God. You follow that? If they're always looking for the things after the flesh, and that's what flesh folk do, when they're always looking for things after the flesh, it is not possible to please God. All right? So Paul lets us know then that people who live in the flesh, these are folk who never made the transition from getting good things from God to consider what a wonderful thing it is and expressing deep gratitude for his provision. They cannot see past the immediate fulfillment of need. Life is good then when they're getting their bellies full. But when they desire some other thing, life is no longer good. They only live from one appetite to another with no metaphysical thought in between them. Their hearts are hardened through unbelief. Now, to do this, I want you to go with me to Mark 6, 32 to 52. Mark 6, 32 to 52. Because what I'm going to try to show you now is what was the basic underlying thing that's going on with them. Mark 6, 32 to 52. And we're not going to read all of these, but I just want you to get kind of a quickie as we go through it. So they departed to a deserted place in the boat by themselves. But the multitude saw them departing, and many knew him and ran there on foot from all the cities. They arrived before them and came together to him. And Jesus, when he came out, saw a great multitude and was moved with compassion for them because they were like sheep not having a shepherd. So he began to teach them many things. And when the day was now far spent, his disciples came to him and said, "This is a deserted place, and already the hour is late. Send them away, that they may go into the surrounding country and villages and buy themselves bread, for they have nothing to eat." But he answered again and said to them, "You give them something to eat." They said to him, "Shall we go and buy 200 denarii worth of bread and give them something to eat?" But he said to them, "How many loaves do you have? Go and see." And when they found out, they said, 5 and 2 fish. Then he commanded them to make them all sit down in groups on the green grass. So they sat down in ranks, in hundreds and in fifties, and when he had taken the 5 loaves and the 2 fish, he looked up to heaven, blessed and broke the loaves, and gave them to his disciples set before them. And the 2 fish he divided among them all. So they all ate and were filled, and they took up 12 baskets full of fragments and of the fish. Now those who had eaten the loaves were about 5,000 men. Let's look our way on down. Now it's time for them to leave. So Jesus tells them to get in the boat and get gone. So on this occasion, he's going to walk on the water. Verse 51 says, "Then he went up into the boat to them, and the wind ceased. They were greatly amazed in themselves beyond measure and marveled, for they had not understood about the loaves, because their heart was hardened." Everybody see that? Why did they not understand about the loaves? Their hearts were hardened. Why? They didn't consider the loaves. They didn't ask, what's the big question? They simply had their bellies full. That was all they needed. And this is the group of guys that Jesus has chosen to be those who will carry the faith on after he's gone. Yes, they even had 12 baskets left over, but they hadn't considered what that means. They went from zero, having nothing, to having 12 baskets full left over when all they wound up finding in the whole crowd was 5 loaves of bread and 2 fish. But they didn't think their way through. Who could do that? Who could do that? Because he didn't think their way through it. Because they only were satisfied with getting there. Now, I'm saying this. Every time we get an answer to prayer, we need to think more than just the relief that prayer gave to the person we were asking it for. We need to ask ourselves, who does that? How's he able to do that? How did that thing happen? Who is this we're serving? Who is this we pray to? Okay. We have kind of the same situation in chapter 8 of Mark and verses 1 to 21. Again, we don't have to read all that. This time it's 4,000. And there, Jesus is asking them a question. He told them to beware of the leaven of the Pharisees, because they will absolutely destroy your faith if you let them. And the disciples who are not getting it said they reasoned among themselves, saying, "It's because we have no bread." So Jesus is just like us. He's concerned that we don't have any bread. Now, think about that just for a moment. This is the Jesus who makes bread. This is the one who takes out of his hand and hands out loaves when there's nothing there. And it's good, solid food. And they think Jesus is worried about not having food. How hard do you have to be before you can't figure out that if you need food, Jesus is going to make it? It's not a big deal. How dumb do you have to be up here not to think? You understand what I'm saying? I'm not saying they're dumber than we were. We probably would have done the same thing. No, I shouldn't speak for you. I'll just go speak for me. But Jesus, being aware of it, said to them, "Why do you reason because you have no bread? Do you not perceive nor understand? Is your heart still hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember? When I broke the five loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of fragments did you take up? They said to him, 12. Also, when I broke up the seven for the 4,000, how many large baskets full of fragments did you take up? They said, 7. He asked, how is it you do not understand? Same thing was going on just prior to that. Because their hearts were hardened by not considering what God had done, they couldn't get the rest of it. Right? Look with me at John chapter 6 just for a minute. John chapter 6. Now, I'm saying this because there are times I believe we need to stop and think about things ourselves. Think our way through some of the miracles we have seen, some of the things that we have seen. Well, Jesus is going to feed the 4,000. He's going to walk on water. We'll come to verse 22. On the following day, when the people who were standing on the other side of the sea saw that there was no other boat there except that one which his disciples had entered, and that Jesus had not entered the boat with his disciples, but his disciples had gone away alone. However, other boats came from Tiberias near the place where they ate bread after the Lord had given thanks. When the people therefore saw that Jesus was not there, nor his disciples, they also got into boats and came to Capernaum, seeking Jesus. And when they found him on the other side of the sea, they said to him, Rabbi, when did you come here? Okay, so they got this miraculous thing going here. They realize this is it's pretty miraculous. How did he get here? Jesus answered and said to them, most assuredly, I say to you, you seek me, not because you saw the signs, that means that see with understanding, saw the signs, but because you ate of the loaves and were filled. Do not labor for the food which perishes, but for the food which endures to everlasting life, which the Son of Man will give you, because God the Father has set his seal on him. Now, I want you to think what it's saying. He knew that people were following him for what he could give them to meet their immediate needs, not because he was the Son of God, not because he was Messiah. Everybody follow where I'm at here? This is critical. Our faith is resting on this. Why are you following Jesus? Why are any of us following Jesus? Is it because we really see he's the Messiah, or is it because he meets our needs? You know? Well, let me go on to the next one. The writer of Hebrews tells us in two places that these people have no faith. I'm going to go back to Hebrews 3:12 through 4:2. Would you turn back there with me? Hebrews 3, verse 12. Through 4, verse 2. He said, beware, brethren, lest there be in any of you an evil heart of unbelief in departing from the living God. But exhort one another daily while it is called today, lest any of you be hardened through the deceitfulness of sin. For we have become partakers of Christ if we hold the beginning of our confidence steadfast to the end. While it is said, today if you'll hear his voice, do not harden your hearts as in the rebellion. For who having heard rebelled? Now look, this is the same group that's in 1 Corinthians 10. This is just a different explanation for what was going on with the group in 1 Corinthians 10. For who, having heard, rebelled, verse 16 says, indeed, was it not all who came out of Egypt and led by Moses? Now with whom was he angry 40 years? Was it not with those who sinned, whose corpses fell in the wilderness? And to whom did he swear that they would not enter his rest, but to those who did not obey? So we see they could not enter in because of unbelief. Therefore, since a promise remains of entering his rest, let us fear lest any of you seem to have come short of it. For indeed the gospel was preached to us as well as to them, But the word which they heard did not profit them, not being mixed with faith in those who heard it. Okay, now, let me see if I can wrap this thing this way. When we hear the message of the gospel, it often is including, this is an opportunity for you to go to heaven and not go to hell. And sometimes that resonates strongly with us. Who wants to go to hell? Well, smart people don't want to go to hell. Not if you really understand what hell is. You don't want to go there. So how do I keep from going there? Believe Jesus, right? What does it mean to believe Jesus? Well, you tell me the formula, and I'll pray the prayer. Okay, here we go. Bow our heads, and we're going to say, Dear Jesus, I'm a sinner. Thank you. I recognize I'm a sinner, and because I'm a sinner, dear Jesus, I want you to come into my heart and save me. And they repeat that after us. And now, they're saved. See, I don't know any of that. But here's the deal. I'm going to say to them, did you pray that prayer? Mm-hmm. Did you mean it? Mm-hmm. What does the word say? You're saved. There you go. Now that person may walk away from you no more saved than they were a macaroni and cheese sandwich. You understand what I mean? Because they don't even know what they believe. They could retain all their old beliefs just now and just added Jesus to it. Matter of fact, that's one of the things you always have to be concerned about in India is since they already have a million or more gods, adding Jesus on is just one more little layer of protection. You see what I'm saying? Oftentimes we will trust Christ as fire insurance, that I won't have to go to hell. So I got a fire insurance policy of trusting Jesus. Listen to what he's saying. That's not faith. That's an acknowledgement of your fear, an acknowledgement that someone told you the alleviation of your fear is this. Faith in Christ is the faith that he is the Christ, that he really is the Son of God, and that he really does have a claim on your life. That's what this is about. And what he's saying is, look, there are some people, all of them got to come out of Egypt, so they're not going to die slaves. Look, all of us who look to Jesus got to come out of the bondage of sin, but we're not all going to make it to the victorious Christian life. I didn't say anything about going to heaven. We're not going to make it to the victorious Christian life, to that place where you can be fruitful. Can I say this? You are judged by your fruitfulness, not by your entrance into heaven. Everybody follow where we're at? You're judged by your fruitfulness. What have you got to show for your life? You've been given everything you need, spiritual gifts, the Spirit itself, promises. All you had to do was believe them and follow. It was that simple. When we chose to do it some other way, when we chose to complain about this salvation, we chose to complain about God because he doesn't always meet our needs, complain about this because he doesn't meet our needs soon enough. Everybody see where I'm at? Hope I'm not boring you with this. I'm just simply saying, these were written for us that we would not lust after evil things. Why? Because I cannot please God when I'm lusting after evil things and I'll die in the wilderness. Two, don't become an idolater. Believe only in God. Don't worship anything else. Don't put your confidence in your bank account. Don't put your confidence in your car. Don't put your confidence in, may I say, other people. Only in Christ. Okay? Don't be an idolater. Don't commit sexual immorality. Don't pervert the things that, and if I could take it, sexual immorality, it would just be one way of saying perverting the things which God has given you. Sexuality is a gift from God. It's made for a marriage, a husband and wife. When we are perverting it in any other way, when we're perverting our lives in any way, that's the same kind of thought. Don't commit sexual immorality. Don't complain. All of those things are things that are not pleasing to God and leave us in the wilderness without the victorious Christian life.